Thank you.
Thank you for that gracious introduction, Lars. I'm delighted and honoured to be here at the Kavli Institute, having heard so much about it. And I might say, I'm very grateful to you for taking some time out this afternoon. I really appreciate that too. I won't detain you too long, but I think it's a great idea that you've got here of getting people like me who are outsiders relative to the research community to say why we're here and why we're so pleased to be among you. I'm particularly excited by the vision of this institution, which relies so strongly on collaboration and talking. I can think of one person who may not possibly have thrived as much as others on this. Oh, you just have to be a picture here. And I'd just like to begin with an anecdote that I don't think is in my book. I think one of the things I cut out because there were so many like it. But it concerned an American biochemist who came over to St. John's College in Cambridge. And he was desperate to meet the great quantum physicist Paul Dirac. But he told me, this biochemist, that Dirac always had this very forbidding aura, like a minor French poet. I still don't understand what he means by that, but he said it was deeply forbidding and never saw him say a word. And he was warned that if you happened to sit next to him at high table, it would not be the sassiest experience you'd had at that table. Anyway, this biochemist had been there for I think it was 6 or 7 months. And each time he'd failed to sit next to his quarry. But finally, I think it was the last day of Lent term, he found himself sitting next to Paul Dirac, who was sitting there in his gown. And true to form, Dirac said absolutely nothing. Nothing at all for 10 minutes while everybody else is chatting away. And this biochemist said, just at the end of the first course, or thought rather, I've really got to pluck up the courage to speak to this guy. Well, I'll probably never have enough opportunity. So he turned to him while Dirac was finishing that first course, and he said, sir, may I ask what you're working on? There was absolutely no response. Second course comes up, nothing. Third course comes up, nothing. Cheese course comes up, nothing. Dessert comes up, nothing. And then the coffee arrives. Still nothing. And then suddenly, Dirac turned to him and said, why do you ask? True story. The conversation did not have a very exciting ending after that. I don't think that's going to be happening here somewhat. Anyway, the reason why I'm here, or the principal reason why I'm here, is I'm researching a new book. I'm coming to the end of my research period, coming to that horrible time when I have to start writing. And it's a book that I, in my modest way, regard as the central miracle of science, and I mean that. Right? That is the mathematical intelligibility of the universe. I love wildlife documentaries. I love looking at physics experiments. I love life as much as anybody else does. But if you ask me on my deathbed, what is the most surprising thing about this place that I have inhabited, it's the fact that the universe is intelligible mathematically. I'm not alone in that. Einstein, great, great physicist, great philosopher of science, remarked on this in one of his last letters to his great friend Sullivan in 1951. And he said, I can't think of any other word to describe this apart from a miracle. And he said, I know people will quibble with that, fair enough, but that's a word I'm going to use. And of course, it doesn't take a lot of imagination to extend that if we didn't have this miracle, our subject, theoretical physics, would just not be possible. Now, in 1960, as I'm sure you're aware, this gentleman's brother-in-law, Eugene Wigner, wrote an extremely influential essay called The Unreasonable Effectiveness of Mathematics, something that's been debated for many years since then. I suspect that some of that derived from conversations with Dirac, but I'm not trying to take any credit away from Wigner for writing an essay that has engendered so much discussion over the years. You all know the arguments. You know, why is it that we can set out theories that go from a kind of Platonic mathematical ideal into and use them to express the laws of nature so profitably? But I detect that we're going into something now that is beyond the unreasonable effectiveness of mathematics to what I think you might better describe as the unreasonable centrality of mathematics. I mean, who now could deny that that it is pretty much impossible to imagine that the laws of nature are written in any other way? They are that mathematics, state-of-the-art mathematics, is cropping up all over fundamental physics. When people embark on fundamental new programs, they find themselves colliding with their friends in the mathematics department. This strikes me as being singular. What I set myself the task of in this book is to try to, it's a difficult task, just like writing this chap's biography here, which Martin Rees advised me not to do, incidentally, to try to bring some of the excitement home of that, of this centrality. And one of the things that prompted me to do this, apart from my own interest in the subject, is that, as you'll be well aware, there's what you might call the commentariat, there is a lot of criticism of very mathematical theoretical physics, in particular string theory, but other types as well, multiverse and what have you. Everyone's entitled to opinion. That's what makes science, drives it forward, and it's fundamentally democratic credentials, so to speak, make it what it is. But I must say that I remember hearing a discussion on a BBC radio program one morning, just after I finished, I was in the middle of the book I wrote after Dirac, and I heard this discussion where a layperson, not a fool, but a layperson, was basically saying that string theory wasn't physics, and that physicists had lost their minds, and they'd lost their bearings, they'd lost their, all sense of historical context and what have you. And I was really very upset about this, because the only people that they put up against this gentleman, right, was an experimenter, my friend John Butterworth, lovely guy, but he doesn't know anything about this subject. And this, in my opinion, is becoming pervasive now. Right? It may not be true here, but there are a lot of very, very well-informed people, right, who think that much of the physics that you do here is basically la-la land stuff, got nothing to do with the real world and what have you. Now, I know that's not true, right? But I think there is room out there for a polite conversation with the general public to explain why we're doing what we're doing here now, that we haven't taken leave of our senses, and that there is a reason for what we're doing doing now. Now, very, very quickly, I just wanted to introduce myself, let you know where I'm coming from, as they now say, give you some idea of how I came be where I am writing that book, and finally, and very quickly, what I hope to achieve by being here, what I hope I can contribute to life here at the Institute. I guess my scientific life began, if I could date it, to a door knock when I was 15 years old in the suburban town of Orpington, where I happened, by virtue of a Saturday job, to knock on the door of somebody who was a theoretical physicist, who I always used to think, well, they all had huge manes of hair, they always away with the fairies. And I met this gentleman by the name of John Bendall, who became a huge impact on my life. He's now well retired, but was a huge impact on my life. Because not just because of his friendliness, but because he introduced me to this person here, who was his hero, total hero. This fellow, John Bendall, read The Principles of Quantum Mechanics every Christmas. He named his daughter Paula. His cat was Adrian. You name it. I mean, he is a serious fanatic, right? And the great disservice he did to me here was that he said, well, you can follow in this path. So, of course, I went it, toddled in, and did theoretical physics, thinking that we could all write papers like this guy. And I got a rude shock, of course, later on, as you can imagine. Very few people have the gifts that Dirac had, and we'll talk about that in another talk. But my career after that was what I call rectilinear. It wasn't a struggle in terms of, because of state provision and because of parental support, I got my first degree, second degree, I got tenure at the Open University, which is the world's largest distance teaching education institution, and then moved on, having realized that I wasn't going to be a great researcher, far too interested in the people behind the subject in its history, not nearly intellectually powerful enough to compete at the level I wanted to compete at, but there we are. Not everyone can be Roger Federer, I realize that. And that was the position I found myself in, but still loved the subject very dearly. And I moved into the museum world in 1990 when I became an assistant director. Later on, I became assistant director at the Science Museum in London. And my contribution there was to try to bring contemporary science into the museum world. It's one of the largest museums in the world about science. And I was always astonished about how out of date museums were and how little they had to say about things that were terribly important to me. For example, you take the two biggest revolutions in 20th century physics, quantum mechanics and relativity, and there's nothing in most museums on those subjects. That struck me as being extraordinary. And I made it my aim, so to speak, to work with my colleagues to try to increase the amount of the representation of physics and indeed modern science in the Science Museum and elsewhere. But all that time, I was yearning to get back into the field that you're working in. To quote an Eagles lyric, this was my position in theoretical physics: you can check out, but you can never leave. Now, on the 8th of August 2002, I found myself on the SS Great Britain, having just given a talk at the Dirac Centenary, exactly 100 years after the great physicist was born in Bristol. And I found myself on that boat and talked with and hit it off with his younger daughter, Monica. And I thought, this is my chance, right? I knew there was a biography of Dirac, quite a good one actually, by Helga Krog. Didn't have the benefit of the internet, a lot of good stuff in it. But I thought, if I know the family, there's a chance here I could make some impact on this. And I had, as I'll mention in my next talk, the most amazing luck. And I do believe in luck, actually, because things were coming out there that had never come out before, and they fell into my lap, which was a great honor. And delight for me. After that, I made what many people regard as a bizarre decision to write a book about the Winston Churchill and the nuclear bomb. The reason why I did that, there were two reasons. First of all, I ask you to imagine how you'd feel if you had been for 10 years ridiculing the prospect of some state-of-the-art topic in your subject ever having any military use. Then there being a catastrophic world war, and then you finding yourself working in private, in secret, for the government. Right? Because that's exactly the position that dozens, in the end, hundreds of physicists and chemists found themselves in the war. And the particular perspective, including this one, incidentally, he was one of the people that worked on that project, doing state-of-the-art applied mathematics, neutron diffusion and what have you, in his back garden in Cambridge. I was fascinated by that intersection with the fact that Churchill, I didn't know this when I started, so this was a piece of luck, I didn't realize that Churchill was the best known writer on the future of science in British popular newspapers in the 1930s, and he wrote dozens of articles about the coming nuclear age. Right? I didn't know, for example, in 1926, when quantum mechanics was red hot, that Winston Churchill, a rambunctious Chancellor of the Exchequer, put aside the most important speech of the year and spent 2 hours dictating a summary of quantum theory. News to me, I've read it, I've seen it, I've held it in my hand. So excuse me?
Was it any good?
It's not bad, actually. No, I'm serious, it's not bad for a layperson. What amazes me is that he would want to do that. You know, it absolutely amazes me. And his sagacity was remarkable. 8 weeks before the discovery of nuclear fission in Berlin, Nazi-run Berlin, he wrote in the most popular newspaper in the world, the News of the World, that we could be on the edge of a nuclear age at this awfully frightening time in world history. It's absolutely amazing to me. I did not know that before I started. Anyway, that's what drove me into that somewhat anomalous project. All the while, owing to my annual visits to the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton, which have been enormously helpful to me, I had been haunted by some of the things this gentleman said. he would hate it if you called him a philosopher. He would absolutely hate that. Although he was taught general relativity by a philosopher, incidentally. But he, although nothing like the same stature of Einstein as a thinker about the nature of the subject, he did do and make some remarkably straightforward and telling contributions to the nature of to our thinking about the nature of physics. And one of them was drawn to my attention by Nadi Seiberg, the famous quantum field theorist, string theorist. And I remember him doing this one Saturday afternoon in the gym at the Institute, where he was there under spousal pressure to try and get into some shape. And he asked me if I'd seen a paper that Dirac had written in 1939 called The Relation Between Mathematics and Physics. Now, ladies and gentlemen, if you do nothing else, right, as a result of this talk and you don't speak to me, please go online and read that paper. Easily Googleable, Dampt, Cambridge, right? Dirac, Relation Between Mathematics and Physics. That paper, I submit, is a masterpiece, right? What is particularly amazing is that he discusses that subject without a single mathematical term in the paper. And I realize, after Nadi pointed this out, that I completely missed its significance. I'd read it in my research and dismissed it because its language was so straightforward, so plain, right, that it couldn't possibly have any moment. Later, I found, talking to Edward Witten, Maldacena, Arkali Hamed, that these people are talking about this paper still quite regularly as a masterpiece of its genre. Let me put up here a quote from that paper that resonated me ever since I read it. This is Dirac in this paper, right? For non-specialist audiences, 1939, up at the University of Edinburgh, invited there by Max Born. He just says quite casually, the mathematician plays a game in which he himself invents the rules, while the physicist plays a game in which the rules are provided by nature. But as time goes on, it becomes increasingly evident that the rules which the mathematician finds interesting are the same as those which nature has chosen. Now, I love that. That to me is absolutely beautifully written, because it is not fancy, there's no jargon, but it captures something that I think is profound. You add that, the whole paper is a wonderful read, seriously. And you could give it to your family if they're not a scientist. Anyone can read this stuff. You add that to his great 1931 paper on magnetic monopoles. I call that his Hamlet, because the paper is all over the place. You can see this guy has just got so much talent, right? So he's just so bubbling with ideas that he's throwing ideas all over the place, right? Like Hamlet, he's Shakespeare's greatest play, but perhaps his least disciplined of those genres, right? You look at that 1931 paper, and you will see there the prediction of the positron, the prediction of the antiproton, right? You see the fantastic paper, his work on the monopole. But at the beginning, he sets out a new agenda for theoretical physics, saying that accelerators are now, experiments are becoming so expensive that we may now have to take the lead from mathematics. Now, I agree. I'm siding myself with the great Yang to saying this was one of the really great contributions to the philosophy of theoretical physics, said in very plain terms, right up front, in that paper. Again, well worth reading. Anyway, stimulated by this, conversations with my friends at the Institute and elsewhere, I thought just maybe there is a prospect here of a shorter book than the ones I've unfortunately been writing to date. And I admit to one weakness, a substantial weakness here, that whenever I tend to write a book, I have a tendency to Kubrickify the subject, by which I mean even a simple idea I turn into something rather grand in structure. That's not always a good thing, particularly for popular books. I remember Maldacena coming up to me and with my Dirac book, and he said, "This is very intimidating." Me intimidating Maldacena? I mean, it's unbelievable. Anyway, I'm determined to try to keep this coming book in reasonable proportions. And I just wanted to tell you very, in very general terms what its structure is, very, very quickly. It's always interested me that if you play the same game that E.M. Forster did when he wrote his great little book on aspects of the novel, he was talking about having great writers sitting around a table, just like they just walked in a room in the Doctor Who episode. So you have Shakespeare there, you have George Eliot, you have Dickens, you know, Steinbeck, and what have you, and you imagine them talking about their craft. Now, historians hate this for good reason, but as physicists, we can't help but imagine, what if Isaac Newton were to walk in here now? What if Maxwell were to walk in here now? It's irresistible. I know it's not legit historically, but since my research began on this, which was 18 months ago, I've started to realize how much historians have got to teach us about how different what you are doing now is to what Newton was doing. He would be very puzzled to come and find out what you are doing now, right? The kind of God-given mathematical laws that we think we're seeking now, that wasn't the way Newton thought at all. That I didn't realize this in my stupendous ignorance, but modern physics, basically, if you look at the subject as we now see it, it's best credited with Laplace and his colleagues in France around just after the French Revolution. I'd always thought this was something that came straight from Newton, but I do, without denying for one second Newton's preeminent genius, it's the only time you'll ever hear me use the word genius, right? The subject has a much more torturous history than physicists often give it credit for. So I chose to begin, I'm working with a lot of historians here, and I know you could begin it, I don't know, with a person getting off its back legs in the African savannah, but I'm going to begin it with Isaac Newton, and then from the Scientific Revolution go through to Laplace, where physics was really invented with a modern sense of Newtonianism. That's when it began, in 1800, right? Maxwell, Hamilton, Dirac, Einstein, up to the period which Freeman Dyson has, with his typical provocativeness, has called the divorce between mathematics and physics, where he said that the subjects are basically separated, each claiming they had no further use for each other, which is a gross oversimplification, but good enough to provoke thought. The second part of my book, which is what I'm researching here, I put all that historical stuff aside, for another few months, is after the mid-70s, which is when I began my graduate work. I think physics has taken a distinctly different tone. I remember, I still remember now, as if it were yesterday, rather like the release of Sergeant Pepper or something. I still remember, right, being a graduate student, and 25 days after becoming a graduate student, the Jabe Psi was discovered. And I remember that excitement, the pandemonium of seeing this incredible particle that really was not very well predicted by theoreticians, and the fantastic interplay between theorists and experiment. And I confess to you, I thought, this is what physics is like. This is what I've read about in books, is physicists working arm in arm with experimenters. And of course, now we know that that is by no means always the case. We might wish it were otherwise, but I want to try to trace how this difference has happened, the reason why it's happened, and there are no ill motives for that trajectory. Now, I'm particularly pleased to be here during the quantum gravity workshop here, of course, and there are a whole bunch of things that I'd be very glad to discuss. There may be things that have occurred to you that haven't occurred to me, which would be absolutely terrific. But among the sort of things I'd like to discuss, obviously, would be that centrality I spoke about. Do you regard that as a miracle, or do you regard it as hardly surprising, since we have brought mathematics to the study of the world, so mathematics is going to be what generates ideas? There's legitimate debate on that, of course. Examples of where mathematics has been surprisingly effective to you. Maybe you think, like Richard Feynman has said on the record, that it's getting out of hand now. I suspect this is Feynman talking, not me, you know, that nature is a good deal less complicated than we're making it. Maybe you suspect that. I don't know. You know far better than I do what the community are thinking. Do you agree with Steve Weinberg, who told me at the University of Texas at Austin a few months ago, that he was actually sad about the state of fundamental theoretical physics now? He said he knows people who are making great careers who've never made a prediction in their lives. He feels that we're waiting for an experimental discovery to kick particle physicists up the backside. That's a slightly cleaned up version of what he actually said to me. Or do you agree with Arkani Hamed, who thinks that he's living in, as Dickens would say, in the best of all possible, not Dickens, who was the other chap, best of all possible worlds, that this is a great time to be working because the problems of the standard model of particle physics and linked up with cosmology are so serious that we're missing something seriously big. So there's a huge prize to be had. Who's right about those two things? Maybe both are. I'd be very happy to talk with anyone, on or off the record. I would say I'm quite serious about this. I love it when people talk dirty, and I don't mean sexually. I mean about very frankly about the subject. And you have an absolute guarantee, said in front of your director, that nothing will be quoted, right, personally, or even communally in terms of this group, unless you have seen it. I think that's very important to give that guaranteed undertaking. If you want to see what I write before it's published, I'm also very glad to indulge you on that. This is my information. I'm here till May the 8th. That's my room, room 1202. First time I ever had a palm tree outside my office, I still can't quite get over it. And this is my my email address here. Whenever you see me around, you know who I am now. Please know that I won't be interrupting you. I'm very respectful of that you're here to be shut away for, if you like, from the real world. But if you do want to speak to a tame writer who's very keen to represent what you do faithfully, then I would be deeply grateful if you'd collar me, come to see me anytime you like. I'm around Santa Barbara virtually the whole time until I leave. So thank you very much again for your time, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you.
Some of your remarks presuppose that I thought that we're all Platonists, and all physicists I've met are, in some sense, mathematical Platonists.
Yep.
But there are philosophers out there.
Absolutely.
There's even a book called Where Mathematics Comes From.
That's right. Yes, that's right.
Where they say math is just the language,
yes,
like French or.
Yeah.
Tibetan. And it's
yeah, right.
It's not fundamental.
Nope.
It's not clear anything's fundamental.
Yeah.
And they would even dispute that pi has any special.
Yes. You're quite right.
Digits of pi are special or anything like that. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So right. Have you looked at their work?
I have.
Is there any merit to it?
I have. I mean, my own view is, again, I'm happy to be disabused of this, but my own view is that mathematicians. But mustn't use the word generally in the word of math, but the great majority are hardcore Platonists. They believe they are discovering things that are out there to be discovered. I also believe, with a little bit more authority, just a little, that physicists are like that. I think that's why they have places like this funded, because there are things that can be discovered, right? And yet I know that philosophically there are people out there who believe this is a complete nonsense. Now my view is that there's never going to be an experiment to distinguish between those two things, right? And I thought you'd like that. But one can carry on regard. But I have to say my book is not going to be a philosophy book. I promise my. But you're absolutely right to draw attention to that. I asked Edward Witten about this, incidentally. You know, he doesn't waste many words. And I asked him if he believed that mathematics was out to be discovered. Yes. All the laws of physics out there to be discovered. Yes. That was it. You know, and I don't think physicists tend to be that interested in developing the subject. But it may be that you disagree with that. And I'd be very happy to talk to people who are exceptions to that.
So what about a lot of physics problems which can be formulated mathematically, but which are so terribly complicated that we have no way of solving them? For example, Navier-Stokes equations in turbulence regimes or the Hubbard model.
Okay.
We know exactly how to formulate mathematically what it's supposed to be like.
Yes.
But we have no way of solving it.
Maybe our ignorance.
Is that ignorance or is there some fundamental problem?
I'm afraid that's way above my pay grade, that one. What can I say? They're always very difficult. I mean, I remember Frank Wilczek once told me that Freeman Dyson said, strong interaction, it'll be decades before anyone, he said that 1970, before Cruise, Wheeljack, or what have you come along. So I think it's dangerous to say, I think it's dangerous to say that string theory will never be tested. You hear these people saying very incautiously. I mean, I never say never. I think one's always got to be very cautious when predicting, especially about the future.
Yeah. So I really would encourage people to interrupt Graham. I would encourage you to indeed walk in the visitor's office. Don't be shy. A special thing about being here is that the visitors have nothing else to do.
If I'm attacked by somebody's office, I can come to you. Can
absolutely.
I?
Right,
okay. Good.
It is an important thing. Like yourself
here. Okay, and I might say I'm a anytime, any place person. So, if you prefer to speak early in the morning or in the evening or what have you, that's fine by me. It's just a privilege for me to talk to so many first-rate theoretical physicists. So, thank you again for coming.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.